Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
...the alleged terror plot to bring down airplanes. Police in Britain reportedly raided the cafes in a town not far from where several suspects in the plot were arrested last week. Joining us on the line from Washington is Josh Meyer, national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And Josh, the president is expected to speak today after a week of tough questions about airline travel and airline security and a morning of meetings with counterterrorism and homeland security teams. As we wait for that, we ask you, apparently you've been looking into parallel plots. Tell us more about that.
Hi, Robin. Well, there's a lot of loose ends that the authorities are following. One of them is this suspected parallel plot, and that's something that's come out in the last few days. Authorities have been scouring computers and other information gleaned from the raids in London and in Pakistan, and one of the things they say is that there might be a parallel plot that's similar to but unconnected to this one. There might be a follow-up plot or something to that of that nature, but they're not sure at this point.
What does that tell you, by the way, that there might be either a parallel plot or a follow-up plot? I'm thinking, of course, of speculation that the original plot that we're speaking of was tied to Al-Qaeda.
Well, you know, I mean, we've been trying to figure, that's the million-dollar question. I wrote a story the other day that I guess has proved fairly prescient, in which I said that, you know, this could be either an Al-Qaeda plot, it could be homegrown terrorists from Britain, it could be Pakistani militant groups, or it could be a combination of all three. And I think authorities are finding out that it's probably going to be door number, four, which is a combination of all three of them. And it's just so hard these days to figure out what's Al-Qaeda and what isn't. I mean, for instance, what, you know, one of the Pakistani militant groups that apparently may have sent money, you know, that was involved in this plot is a group called Lashkar-e-Taiba, which after it was banned in Pakistan changed its name to something else. But it's a very according to some authorities, malevolent Pakistani militant group that has many similarities to Al-Qaeda.
Josh Meyer, national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We mentioned that the president has been meeting all morning with his homeland security and counterterrorism teams. And we understand also there's been a lot of pressure, mostly from within the Republican Party, to institute some of the same security measures in the U.S. that are being used in Great Britain, among them profiling. What are the conversations going on about that?
The conversations are all over the map, and this happens every time there's a plot like this. I mean, I read in one paper that Attorney General Gonzalez has ordered a review of our counterterrorism laws and procedures in comparison to the ones in Britain. But he's done that at least several times, as I can remember, since he took office a few years ago. So, I mean, I think that this sort of is a cyclical thing. I think we're looking in the United States at several things. One is trying to expand on the authorities that we have. Britain can detain people for 28 days without charging them, I believe. We can't do that. But there's a lot of things that Britain can do that we can't do, that I know Mike Chertoff, when he was head of the criminal division at the Justice Department, told me personally that he would have loved to have done way back then. So they've been looking at this for a while. One thing they're also considering is creating an MI5, which is Britain's internal security service. It's sort of a domestic intelligence gathering operation to supplant the FBI or augment it.
Well, and I'm sure the president isn't expected to say anything about that today. But
what
can he say to communicate, especially as you are reporting, there's a possible parallel second plot that's being investigated. What can the president say?
You know, it's always a puzzle to me what they're going to say about these things, but you know, I'm not sure he can just say that we're staying on top of it. I think one thing that he needs to address is why the Homeland Security apparatus wasn't mobilized aggressively in recent years to try to counter the threat of liquid explosives on planes. I believe that, you know, several million dollars that could have been spent on that was redirected elsewhere, and I think that's one of the main criticisms is not as much the counterterrorism effort, but the Homeland Security effort to harden the target, including airlines.
Josh Meyer, national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Again, President Bush is expected to make a statement today regarding counterterrorism measures after meeting all morning with his counterterrorism teams. Josh, thanks for checking in with us.
You're welcome.
Well, now that a fragile ceasefire seems to be holding in Lebanon, the question is being asked, who won the war. The U.S. and Israel claim that the militant group Hezbollah suffered a defeat in the month-long fighting, but the group's Iranian backers and Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah are calling it a strategic, historic victory of an Arab army over Israel. It may also be a sign of a Shia revival. Hezbollah is a militant Shiite Muslim group. Shiism is the more mystical branch of Islam, long despised by more moderate, some say conservative, Sunni Muslims. And Vali Nasser, a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in California, says that the U.S. unintentionally opened a Pandora's box in the region when it liberated the oppressed Shia minority of Iraq. And Lebanon may be just one of the places where we're seeing the consequences. Professor Nasser joins us on the line from a studio in New York City. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Your book takes us through so many different branches of the branches of Islam and helps us navigate what can sometimes seem, to a Westerner, like an impenetrable thicket. We have talked about some of the differences between Sunni and Shia on this program before, but how would you give it an overarching thought? Is it like the difference between Protestants and Catholics?
Yes, I think that's a very useful comparison. This is the major divide within Islam, the major sectarian divide. Its origins goes back to the very early years of the faith over a dispute over who should succeed Prophet Muhammad. But from that early beginning, then the two faiths developed as different interpretations of Islam. They have a different read on text, on law, on the practice of Islam, on the ethos of Islam. The Sunnis are more legalistic and more literal in the reading of the text, and they don't accept an intermediary between man and God in matters of faith. Everybody can have an access to the text. Whereas the Shiites do view that there is an intermediary between man and God, and that those intermediaries were the saints, the people who they believed early on in their history should have been the leaders of the community who are descendants of the Prophet. And in this sense, they're much more like Catholics. And one visible way in which they are different is that the Shiites do practice certain festivals and activities, such as the famous festival of Ashura.
Well, and we saw this for the first time, or many Westerners saw this for the first time recently when Shia practiced Ashura in Iraq. There was self-flagellation?
Yes. Ashura marks the death of the third Shia imam. His name was Hussein. He was the grandson of the Prophet. He was a claimant to the true leadership of the Muslim community. And because the caliph at the time, who was sitting in Damascus, saw threat in him, he sent a very large army who, after several days of battle, killed Hussein and his companions in a very brutal way. And that slaying of Hussein has served, much like the crucifixion of Christ in Christianity, as the one event in which a sort of an innocent individual bearing the truth stands up to authority and is put down in an unjust way, and that it becomes the formative event of the faith.
You describe in the book being on a research trip in Pakistan when the first scenes of that massive Shiite religious celebration in Iraq were televised worldwide. That was back in April 2003, just after Saddam was overthrown. How did your Sunni hosts react to that?
Well, there was a combination of shock and, in some ways, disapproval. And for the first time, they were seeing practices that didn't look familiar to them. Secondly, the scenes showed that the Shiites were standing up, practicing those aspects of their faith that are most divorced from Sunnis. I mean, in other words, you were not showing Shiites at prayer. You were showing them at Ashura. And these were interpreted, if you would, as unwelcome signs coming out of Iraq. Namely, you have the other sect of Islam that had been suppressed, whose practices were condemned, who was kept at bay by Sunni powers, now raising its head and claiming its place and essentially putting forth its own practices. And these were seen as ominous signs.
Well, and the central point of your book is that now the whole Middle East is experiencing this Shia revival. In Lebanon, where the Shia militant group Hezbollah is declaring itself victorious. You just mentioned, of course, Iraq. But before Iraq, long before Iraq, there was the Ayatollah Khomeini's Shia-backed revolution in Iran.
Well, when Ayatollah Khomeini took over Iran, there was a mini Shia revival, but it never really led to, if you would, a genuine movement across the region. What we're seeing in the Middle East is not quite different. We're seeing a revival that is based on two pillars. One is political, namely Shiites everywhere in the Arab world face the same problem as the Shiites of Iraq, and that is that they don't have rights. Their position in society is not legitimated or accepted, and they don't get a share of the wealth and the resources. They don't have a seat at the table. And it doesn't matter whether they were a majority, as in Iraq or Bahrain, or if they were a minority, as in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, or Lebanon. It was the same story. They looked at what happened in Iraq, namely, it was possible for Sunni domination to collapse, and that when there is voting, there is a transfer of power to Shiites. So Iraq was hope to them. The second pillar of this revival is the fact that Iraq is the heart of Shiism. That's where the shrine cities are. That's where the traditional seat of Shia learning is. And the opening of Iraq allowed hundreds of thousands of them, particularly from Iran, to travel to these cities. And this renewed an emotional attachment. It also created new business that crisscrossed through Iraq but connect Iran and Pakistan to the Arab world. And this cultural revival combined with the political dynamism is what I would call a Shia revival. Namely, there is a new force in the region at the popular level that is now deciding the politics in that part of the world.
So, Ali Nasser, what do you think the result of that is? And do you think that the U.S.-led coalition in toppling Saddam and sort of, you know, unleashing and liberating the majority Shia in Iraq, Do you see that as a liberation of Shia? And we should say you are a Shia from Iranian by birth. Or do you think that this was an unanticipated upsetting of the apple cart in the region?
It was an upsetting of the apple cart. I don't think the Bush administration really thought through what regime change in Iraq would do in terms of sectarian conflict. I don't think everybody in the region was unhappy about it. In others, the Shiites in Iraq or Shiites elsewhere in the Arab world do not like occupation, invasion, or war. But their consequence was beneficial politically to them. It opened the door for them. But then the United States was not really proactive in trying to consolidate on that gain. And as a result, has gradually found itself in conflict with the Shiites in Iraq as well as in Iran and Lebanon as well. And therefore, the consequences did not necessarily benefit the United States.
Ali Nasser, a professor of Middle East and South Asia politics at the Naval Postgraduate School in California, also author of the new book, The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. Now, we've been talking about the differences between Shia and Sunni Muslims. Of course, in his book, he points out that within Shia Islam, there are major differences, much like within Protestantism. There's a huge distinction between, say, Episcopalians and Baptists. Other groups, it's maybe slightly more nuanced, let's say, between Methodists and Lutherans. There's the same issue with studying Shia. And, of course, not all Sunni Muslims hate the Shia. We'll hear how those differences within the different branches of Islam are playing out in the Middle East, and also why, in Ali Nasser's words, a war on Shiism is now a war on America, and a war on America is now a war on Shiism. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. And I want to turn to Lebanon, where a Shia intellectual recently wrote a risky, scathing editorial criticizing the Shia group Hezbollah for endangering the Lebanese people. Another Shia wrote an open letter to Iran, saying Iran was using groups like Hezbollah without concern for how Shia in Lebanon would be affected. So Shia obviously don't speak with one voice. And Professor Nasser, how do you see the Shia revival playing out in Lebanon?
Well, once Hezbollah started this war, the reaction in the Arab world from Arab leaders and radical Sunni clerics was to characterize Hezbollah as a Shia organization and to call on the people not to follow them. In other words, Hezbollah started this war as an Arab-Israeli war, as a Palestinian issue, but the Arab world very quickly turned it into a sectarian war. And I think the sectarian issue now looms very large in Lebanon. Namely, Hezbollah has a hold over the Shia community, which is now about 45% of Lebanon. The rest of Lebanon was not in favor of this war, was not participating in Hezbollah's decision-making, and may very well react adversely to the fact that Hezbollah had taken upon itself to take Lebanon into such a devastating war. But I think ultimately part of the problem with Hezbollah and Lebanon is that the political structure in Lebanon does not reflect the demographic reality of Lebanon. The distribution of power in Lebanon is still based on a census that was taken in 1932, which placed the Christians at the top, followed by Sunnis, followed by the Shia as a minority.
Right now, by law, the president and prime minister can't be Shia.
That's right. And therefore, the Shia, who are the largest community, don't really have access to executive positions. They have only had the say at the executive level by through Syria and the proxy of a pro-Syrian Christian president. But all of this charade of politics in Lebanon makes for the instability, for the rivalry, and for the animus that now this war is likely to bring to the fore.
Vali Nasser, I just want to know what your overarching thought is, because you write about a region that's been destabilized in part because of the Shia revival, and unwittingly by the U.S., who might have unleashed the Shia forces, let's say, in Iraq. But the Shia, as you also point out, have been incredibly oppressed by many Sunni over almost a millennia. So what are you saying? Is this a good thing or a bad thing, the Shia revival?
I think the Shia revival was an inevitable thing. You cannot possibly say that regimes like those of Iraq or Bahrain, wherein the majority of the population is ruled over by a minority who doesn't share power and resources, is a good thing. And when you reach a past the tipping point where the demands of that community and its sizes requires change. So I think, it was an inevitable thing. It is how do you handle an inevitable thing that can be good or bad? What's happened in Iraq is not good because the very first case of transfer of power from Sunnis to Shiites in the Arab world has gone really, really badly. If we looked at Iraq for 3 years, the Shiites showed restraint under the leadership of Ayatollah Sistani, believing that the storm of Sunni resistance and anger would blow over. But when their shrine was destroyed in Samarra, they said, enough is enough. There's not going to be a coexistence. And the only way that you're going to get power to the Shiites and subdue the Sunnis is by an eye for an eye, is through retaliation and establishing a balance of terror, which they began to do, unfortunately, since then. And I think the U.S., by not recognizing the relationship of Hezbollah to the Shia revival, has also conducted this war in a way that will likely alienate the Shias in the region in a meaningful way, and is going to make it much more difficult to manage the Shia-Sunni rivalry in this region for years to come.
What do you think needs to happen?
I think what needs to happen is that the U.S. has to recognize that this is real, in particular after Lebanon, it's clear that it is real. Namely, everybody, including Israelis, Arab governments, the U.S. is saying that there is an Iran-Hezbollah axis that has now successfully taken over the Arab-Israeli issue, the most important conflict in this region. Everybody is acknowledging that there is a power in that region which is outside of the traditional ways in which we thought about that region. It's in Iran and it's in Hezbollah. Now, we have to deal with that power. We cannot manage our affairs in that region but without dealing with that power. I don't believe military option against that power is any more in the cards, because the war in Lebanon has shown that shock and awe could not destroy Hezbollah. And so you have to think of what other way are you going to deal with it. And I think you need to engage the forces that speak for the Shia, because the Shia are half of that region, and the United States cannot have a presence in the Middle East without talking to the forces that represent half of that region.
Talking to Iran.
Well, talking to Iran is imperative, and talking does not mean recognizing. Does not mean that you give Iran a free pass on suppression of its own population and misbehaving in the region. It means that you need to have a line of contact, a diplomatic line of contact, with a power that everybody in the region, from Saudi Arabia to Israel, is recognizing as being the main force behind the current conflict.
One last question. How do you feel about the future? Do you feel positive that this Shia revival will somehow be funneled in a positive way, or do you despair?
I do despair because I think it is that cleavage between the Shias and Sunnis has now sort of interacted with the major conflict in the region, which is the Arab-Israeli conflict, and it will have a bearing on the other looming conflict in the region, which is the U.S.-Iran relations. I think what we're seeing in the region is a set of cascading conflicts, all of which have now this strand of Shia-Sunni relationship within it. That is the conflict in Iraq, the conflict in Lebanon, and the conflict with Iran. And our approach to these conflicts has been that they have nothing to do with one another and that they can be dealt with completely separately. And as a result, I don't think our policy is in sync with the reality on the ground. And I fear for these set of cascading conflicts to ultimately produce a situation which can overwhelm our ability to be able to manage them and ability of other governments in the region to be able to manage them.
Vali Nasser, Mideast scholar at the Naval Postgraduate School in California, also author of the new book, The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. Well, stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston.
For abortions could become one of the big issues. The Senate and House both passed bills making it illegal to help a minor cross state lines to obtain an abortion without parental consent. Lawmakers from both houses will try to work out the differences in their bills when Congress reconvenes next month. But Republicans hope for a speedy resolution so they can trumpet the bill's passage while campaigning for the November elections. We wanted to take a close look at the bills as well with Helena Silverstein. She's a professor of law at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania. Professor, first of all, what are the major differences between the two bills?
Well, both bills would make it illegal to assist a minor crossing state lines to get an abortion when in doing so the minor would be going out of her home state where her home state requires parental involvement in her abortion decision. The House bill, in addition, would penalize a physician for performing an abortion in contravention of the minor's home state's regulations.
And just to be clear, neither bill would penalize the minor or her parents.
That's correct.
Right. Well, first of all, how does this bill fit into the ongoing political battle? What does each side hope to achieve?
Well, certainly this is symbolically a strong pro-life regulation. It is a measure that advances the position of the pro-life view, which is that abortion is problematic and that people, whether they're minors or adult women, shouldn't be having abortions. So it is really trumpeted, even though it's a Child Custody Protection Act, is what the Senate version is called, it is really trumpeted by those who advocate the pro-life position.
And those who are against the bill, largely Democrats, are saying, among other things, that states already have, I think 35 of them already have parental consent laws. So where does this come into play?
There are that many states that have parental involvement requirements, whether it's parental consent or notification. And those who oppose this regulation say those laws are already in effect and provide the safeguards that those states want. And those who oppose the Child Custody Protection Act say that this would harm minors and cause real damage to those minors who, for some reason, need to go to a different state in order to get an abortion, for example, to avoid family dysfunction or potentially an abusive family, and where a minor may not be able to take advantage of the safeguards of the bypass options that exist in her home state.
Yes, you mentioned the bypass options. The response to that claim that some girls, for instance, may be victims of abuse by their own family members, and so parental consent would be harmful to them, and they need someone to take them across state lines. The response to that is, well, you can still get an abortion by getting permission from a judge in many states. How does that work, and why isn't that enough?
Well, that's an excellent question. On the surface, this law, the Child Custody Protection Act, seems very commonsensical because the abortion laws that require parental involvement have these what are called judicial bypass options, where a minor can petition a judge for a bypass of parental consent or notification if the minor doesn't want to involve her parents or if the parents have refused to assist her in the abortion. The problem is that those bypass options do not work nearly as well as they are supposed to. In fact, research suggests that those bypass options fail really quite miserably in the states where they are supposed to be in effect. So, for example, in Pennsylvania, two-thirds of the courts that are supposed to handle the bypass option don't know that it exists and aren't ready to give minors their rights under the law.
Proponents of the bill also say that some abortion providers are advertising to girls in neighboring states to let them know, you know, come across state lines, you can get a procedure without telling your parent. Is that happening?
That is, in fact, happening, and you can look in some of the advertisements and see that abortion providers are advertising in that kind of way. And so supporters of this bill believe that the abortion providers are trying to lure minors across state lines in an effort to really violate the minors' home laws requiring parental involvement.
Is there any sense of how many young women cross state lines with someone else, you know, helping them to avoid parental consent to get an abortion procedure?
There isn't really any clarity in terms of the magnitude of minors going across state lines. There is research that suggests that when a parental involvement law goes into effect in one state, that the number of minors that cross state lines to a neighboring state that doesn't have such a requirement increases. And so studies in Mississippi and Massachusetts have shown that that is in fact the case. And proponents of the Child Custody Protection Act paint a picture, a really grim picture, of the abusive adult male who wants the minor to go across state lines to have an abortion against the minor's will. And there really isn't any evidence of that, aside from anecdotal accounts.
But is there any evidence of who might be taking these girls cross borders? We've heard of, for instance, grandparents or other adult female friends.
Sure. There's plenty of anecdotal evidence that it is friends of minors, it is close relatives of minors, a grandparent maybe, and also sometimes it is a boyfriend, but a boyfriend not who is necessarily being abusive to the minor or forcing her to have an abortion against her will, but a supportive boyfriend who is helping the minor carry out her will.
Well, a recent Gallup poll shows 69% of Americans support parental consent laws, and that's one reason Republicans really want this law passed and signed by the president in time for midterm elections. What position does that polling put Democrats in?
Democrats are in a very tough spot with respect to this law. This is a law that is very hard to vote against because it has such a common sense appeal. The law is touted as protection of parental rights over their minor daughter children. The law has common sense appeal because it is designed supposedly to protect young women, young, maybe immature women, against abusive boyfriends. So the law has just this great common sense appeal. And if you add to that the supposed protections of the judicial bypass option, it's an extremely hard law to vote against. However, the reality of this law is that the judicial bypass option doesn't provide the safeguards that it's intended to provide. And there are real reasons to be concerned about minors' health and well-being should this law be put into effect. And I am, and some Democrats, certainly the avid pro-choice Democrats, will be the ones to vote against this bill.
It's also widely assumed that this bill is part of a shift in strategy by anti-abortion advocates attempting to chip away at certain abortion rights instead of trying to outlaw abortion wholesale by challenging Roe v. Wade. If that is true, what do you see as the next front?
Well, this is, I think, without a doubt, one in a series of pushes to chip away at the right to abortion established in Roe versus Wade and affirmed in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And there are, I think, multiple fronts. Certainly the regulations that would ban so-called partial birth abortion are a very significant front. And there are all sorts of other potential regulations that would bolster informed consent requirements for both minors and adult women, things like requiring women to have an ultrasound or a sonogram before they have an abortion. Those are the kinds of regulations that are increasingly being suggested in order to try and push women away from having abortions.
Helena Silverstein, a professor of law at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania, talking about the new laws regarding minors crossing state lines without parental consent to obtain an abortion, a law under consideration. Helena, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Here and Now.
as I was bending down and kind of being shoved over, I was looking out the corner, like in the crack of the door was opening, you know, and I saw, you know, I saw Alan was there, and I saw them kill Alan. Then they got in the car, and we drove off, and they were screaming, "Jihad, jihad, jihad," and they were, like, overjoyed, like they won the lottery.
That's reporter Jill Carroll describing the day she was kidnapped and watched as her friend and interpreter Alan was murdered while they both covered the war in Iraq for the Christian Science Monitor. Jill has been largely silent about her experience until now. This week, the Monitor began an 11-part series about the kidnapping, Jill's 82 days in captivity, and the Monitor's efforts to gain her release this past March. Jill had been a contributor to Here and Now, and we'll have links to her account at our website. But the series also features contributions from others, including Mideast correspondent Dan Murphy, who joins us now. And Dan, the series is fascinating, but it also, we understand, will break some news that Jill's kidnappers were a part of a ring?
It certainly seems that way. In fact, we couldn't take it and prove it in court, but I personally am 99% convinced that the head of her kidnappers and the people that really organized this were involved in the kidnapping of four Christian peacemakers. We believe they had some ties to the kidnapping of Margaret Hassan, and also to a number of other women journalists who were kidnapped in 2004, most notably Giuliana Segrina, an Italian journalist. Certainly with the news that some of these people have arrested, you know, that's something we can feel pretty good about.
What Jill's doing is putting together the puzzle parts, things that she heard while in captivity. Now she's piecing together with timelines and realizing that, you know, these men are more than likely, as you said, a part of this ring. But the details that she's revealing as well are fascinating. She was with women and children. She was moved around a lot. She watched Oprah at one point.
The first thing we have to remember is that clearly Jill's memory is quite extraordinary in terms of the level of detail she's able to get into in these things. But certainly on her first night in captivity, they you know, after murdering her friend Alan and terrifying her all day, they said, "Hey, would you like to watch TV?" And she describes that switching the channels was like wandering into a minefield. You know, you could find a scantily clad woman that would drive them over the edge. You could find some kind of political discussion or a speech by George Bush that would drive them over the edge. So finally, she stumbles across Oprah, and she's reckoning she's on pretty safe, non-controversial territory there, and they all sat down and happily watched for half an hour.
Dan, just a question of interest to us. This is the Christian Science Monitor. To remind our listeners, and to put it very simply, Christian scientists believe in the power of prayer to heal and solve other problems. They don't use traditional medicine, for instance. And we are reading an ad from the Mother Church here in Boston, where the newspaper is based. It reads, "A time to thank God. The prayers of individuals around the world resulted in Jill Carroll's release." Again, this comes from the Mother Church. But I'm just wondering, as a reporter, how that sits with you. Because, you know, there's an implication that, oh, the prayers of Nicholas Berg's family or the Pearl family, two others who were killed while in captivity, you know, weren't enough.
Well, I think it's a reasonable question to ask, and clearly, and to be perfectly honest, I'm not a Christian scientist myself, and not a man of any particular faith. However, you know, I do believe the sincerity with which that sentiment is, you know, is expressed by the Church and their belief in prayer and what use it can do, and it certainly is proven time and again to be an enormous comfort to all sorts of people. I certainly, you know, wouldn't feel comfortable if the implication is some people's prayers are worth more than others. Certainly, a lot of factors came together to eventually bring Jill safely home.
By the way, how does Jill feel about that? Does, you know, is this? I mean, it's just an interesting question. Here you are at the Christian Science Monitor. You are all, you know, we think terrific reporters. And there's this other element. I mean, how does she...
Remember, the paper, while it is, of course, owned by the Church, is not meddled with in any way. I've worked for them for 6 years and have never had any issues on these matters. And nobody's ever discussed with me, for instance, what my personal faith might or might not be. And I know that's the case for Jill. However, you know, the important thing to remember is that like a guy like Danny Pearl, who's, of course, killed in Pakistan, like Nicholas Berg and so many others that have been killed in Iraq, many, many people have suffered at the hands of kidnappers and ended up murdering their captives, and most of them are Iraqis, and their families pray hard for them as well, and it's very sad that those prayers aren't answered, and the, you know, hopefully peace is going to come to Iraq, and that's something maybe we all should pray for.
Dan Murphy, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Again, Jill Carroll's series, her first-person account of her kidnapping in Iraq is in the paper this week. Dan, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Much more ahead. Hear 'em now. and told the nation that we continue to face, quote, an extremist group of folks.
And that plot is, and this building and the work going on here really is indicative of the challenge we face, not only this week, but this year and the years to come.
The president's statements follow a morning of meetings with counterterrorism and homeland security teams and nearly a week of tough questions from Republicans and Democrats about how to make airline travel more secure. So for a quick look at the politics of the current terrorism, we turn to Rick Klein of the Boston Globe. And Rick, just remind us, what did the president say about his meetings this morning with security and counterterror teams?
Well, I mean, he said there was sort of the basic check-in on what folks are doing and assured people that everything's being done that can be done to combat the terror threats. But I think it's indicative of what's going on in both parties right now, where Democrats and Republicans are sort of feeling out the political climate around the recent terrorist threat and trying to figure out what the impact's going to be.
And there's been a fair amount of pressure, some say from mostly within the president's own party, to institute a security measure such as profiling. What's that conversation like?
Well, it's always touchy. I mean, as more of these events unfold and people do fit a profile, it becomes a harder thing to just dismiss out of hand. But there's always a big backlash in a number of communities when something like that is discussed, and there is pressure from within his party and outside his party. I mean, there's a lot of questions that Democrats have raised recently. Is if we've known that these liquids do pose a potential threat, as in the British plot, then why have they been allowed on airplanes for these last 5 years since 9/11.
And so there's no question that in the few seconds we have that this being a political season, it is the current plot is going to be looked at through a political prism.
No question. And I think the Democrats are being particularly aggressive in pointing out areas where they say Bush has made the world less safe. And I think that's a stark contrast to some previous election cycles where they've been a little hesitant on questions of terror.
Rick Klein covers Washington for the Boston Globe, commenting on President Bush's comments today. Rick, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we want to switch gears just a little bit, and what's better for a mood swing than toe-tapping accordion music? How about four accordions? Throw in a percussionist for good measure, and that's the idea behind the Maine Squeeze. That's an accordion ensemble based in Peaks Island, Maine. Producer Katie Tularski brings us the story.
A one, a two, a one, two, three.
I think there's been an accordion revival over the last number of years.
There are accordions in so many different cultures around the planet.
You know, the accordion is king, basically. It's the king of instruments.
The Maine Squeeze.
The Maine Squeeze.
Maine Squeeze.
The Maine Squeeze Accordion Ensemble.
Thought it was a perfect name for an accordion band in Maine. The Maine Squeeze can tailor what we're doing to the event, to the audience.
We do a lot of festivals, parades, outdoor parties.
We can emphasize the Italian songs. We could emphasize the French songs. We can emphasize the sing-alongs.
I think the beauty of our band is that it's fun.
I'm Sally Trice. I joined the Squeeze about maybe 7 years ago. I love music, and I love listening to music, but nothing's better than making music.
I'm Nancy Three Hoffman.
I would love to do that.
Of course, Nancy's the leader and the singer.
I like languages. I sing in a lot of languages. The accordion just fits well with all that ethnic music.
Hi, I'm Janine Blatt.
Janine, it's amazing. When you watch her play, she's just putting her whole body into the playing.
It becomes kind of an expression of you with the bellows in the air and the pulling and the pushing, and so it just takes you into it.
My name is Barb Truex.
Barb is just an awesome percussionist.
It's important for me to be situated amongst them because they are relying on me to make sure they know where the beat is. When we're doing something like a parade, I only play the washboard.
Hi, I'm Peter Blackstone.
Peter is our jazz man, jazz and blues man.
Just a nice and easy blues.
It's a chord monster, this machine. I'm looking to like really stretch out into rock, you know, because, you know, it's a wild instrument.
A lot of people associate the accordion with polkas.
The Pennsylvania polka. It is everything a polka is supposed to be, and it starts off with the sort of standard introduction. Da 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 da.
If you've ever been at a dance where people are doing the polka, it's like the most punk rock thing going. You know, people just smashing into each other, you know, racing across the floor. Some of the old traditional songs are fabulous party songs.
I was 10 years old, and one of my classmates brought in for the Christmas party his brand new little white accordion, and he played a song. Pa, pa, something like that. And I was absolutely captivated. And I thought, I've got to have one of those. I've got to have one of those. I still remember my father taking out his wallet and plunking down $210. And the plan was that I would pay him back because I did chores on the farm at 40 cents an hour. And I practiced faithfully. And I just love this instrument.
When you're playing music, you're kind of letting go of all the other day job pieces of your life, and you can lose yourself in it, and it's kind of renewing.
I think the accordion is an instrument that makes people smile. Because we do music from so many different genres and so many different countries, by sharing different cultures, we're instilling that seed of acceptance and appreciation in our audience.
I think people get a little surprised at seeing four or five accordions at once. And that will always catch somebody's eye.
Producer Katie Tularsky's visit with the accordion ensemble, The Main Squeeze, was produced at the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies and provided to Here and Now through the Public Radio Exchange. Oh, I want to hear more accordions. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now. There's the accordion.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll hear the debate over profiling passengers.